From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made on your Facebook page. You post a few photos, maybe a few status updates. You don't even consider yourself all that active. But you have the page, and Facebook has some of your information. How much information? What are they doing with it? Who else is getting your information? Well, last month, BuzzFeed's Ben Smith predicted that big changes are coming for big technology, and he wasn't just talking about Facebook. He sees Google and Amazon as other examples of powerhouses that are primed for a hard fall. He writes, quote, "The new corporate leviathans that used to be seen as bright new avatars of American innovation are increasingly portrayed as sinister new centers of unaccountable power, a transformation likely will have major consequences for this industry and for American politics," end quote. So what exactly does that mean? Well, for starters, Smith points out that both Steve Bannon and Bernie Sanders have called for big tech companies to be treated as public utilities. Some have pushed back, arguing that Americans love big tech. Is that true? Are you a fan of Facebook, Google, Amazon, or have your opinions of those brands changed in recent years? Well, my guests this hour have a lot to say on these matters, and let me say hello to Scott Maloof, an attorney whose work focuses on the intersection between social media and the law. Scott, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Mike Johansson is a lecturer at RIT's School of Communication, and he's a social media consultant with Fixitology. Mike, welcome back to you as well.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
As we go throughout this hour, I will read your comments, and they have been pouring in the last hour when I asked, you know, to just in general, have people's opinions changed on those big brands, Google, Facebook, Amazon? What did you think about them 5 years ago? What do you think about them today? Has that changed? And you can tell us what you think. The reason that matters is Ben Smith is saying they are becoming less popular and viewed more suspiciously, and it will be easier for Congress to go in and whack them, to take them apart with antitrust laws or something here. Scott, starting on the legal side of things, do you believe that Ben Smith is right, that they should be worried, they should be consulting with their attorneys, that they should be preparing congressional testimony?
Well, I think anytime you lose public support, you want to be concerned. And anytime, especially as a technology or a provider of any kind of service, people are less happy with what you do, you want to be concerned. And then finally, you know, it's understandable that Congress people are responding to their constituents. But to say, you know, take them down, I don't think, unless they're showing there's an illegal activity or a promise that has not been kept, which is a technology company issue, it's going to be hard to, quote, take them down.
And we'll talk a little bit more throughout this hour about what that would mean. I mean, Scott has some thoughts on what it would mean from a number of different angles. Antitrust, monopoly, et cetera, or treat them as public utilities, you know, whether that is an idea that could be on the table or not. But Mike Johansson, do you agree with the premise that they're becoming less popular, big tech?
To some extent, yes. I think people are becoming a little bit wary. They were bright, shiny objects in the OOs, and I think in the O10s, they've become a little less bright and shiny. And I think there's enough people out there that have had a bad experience or two, and word gets around, that kind of thing. You know, someone's Facebook page gets hacked. Somebody's Amazon package doesn't arrive as promised. Or the worst case scenario, of course, is your information shows up somewhere you didn't expect it to show up, or you're being served up ads you don't know how they got there because you said something to Alexa, you were talking to your wife about something or other on Alexa, and all of a sudden Amazon's serving up ads for the very same object. Creepy, huh?
Yes, I would say that's at a minimum. And Mark on Twitter writes to us and says, Facebook and Google went from cool things that helped you find what you wanted and stay connected to amoebas of social destruction. Well, that's a strong remark, but Tyler Cowen, who wrote a piece for Bloomberg recently, would agree. We'll get to that coming up here. Listeners, if you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. So Ben Smith says the left and the right both have problems with Google, Facebook, and Amazon for different reasons. He writes, quote, "Nationalists accurately see a consolidation of power over speech and ideas by social liberals and globalists at these companies. The left accurately sees consolidated corporate power. Those are the ascendant wings of the Republican and Democratic parties, and this has led to a kind of murder on the Orient Express alliance against big tech. Everyone wants to kill them." So that's Ben Smith writing in BuzzFeed. So two things here. Let's talk about monopoly power. You had Yelp's policy chief, Luther Lowe, speaking to Fox News' Tucker Carlson about whether Google's concentrated power hurts consumers. Let's listen to what Luther Lowe had to say about why he thinks it's not just about, hey, they've got a lot of power, they're popular, they've concentrated a lot of the industry, and I think Mike Johansson has some stats just on Facebook and Google in terms of search. But Luther Lowe is saying, this is hurting people, and here's how. Let's listen.
You actually do have direct effects of consumer harm. When a mom does a search for a pediatrician in Salt Lake City today on Google, instead of getting matched with the best possible information, highly rated doctors of, you know, local doctors and pediatricians, she's instead getting this Google Plus local box. And so there is much better content across the web from services like ZocDoc, RateMDs, HealthGrades, but what Google has done is basically push down these third-party services and sort of hardwired its own inferior content, content which hasn't gone through the same type of meritocratic processes that it sends everybody else through. And so, in that sense,
you can pay to rise to the top of
it. It's not actually a pay-to-play thing. It's like there's a bucket. There's sort of three buckets of click and land. One is the advertising world. One is sort of the Tin Blue Links meritocracy world. And Google has sort of created this third bucket, which is their own closed-off sandbox that they are force-feeding to users unwittingly, because 40% of all of our search, it's the biggest category in search, is local intent-based. So people looking for Main Street small businesses in the offline world. And so what happens is they drop these boxes, which on smartphones, where Google has a 98% durable market share, it takes up the whole screen, and people basically go into that experience assuming that's the stuff at the, that's the best stuff out there.
That's Yelp's policy chief Luther Lowe speaking on Fox News. Mike Johansson, do you agree with what you're hearing there, that Google has sort of gamed the system and that's hurting consumers?
Well, sure. I mean, and you know, they're looking after their enlightened self-interest, if you like. So they control, I think, overall in search now, it's something like 40% is controlled by Google, 35% is on Facebook. So 75% of all search out there for anything is going through those two behemoths. So that's kind of bad news for little guys, medium-sized guys, or people who just aren't getting a lot of attention otherwise. It's very hard to get started out there and get found. Now, a service like Yelp, which is an incredibly good service, if you don't use Yelp itself to find a local restaurant or a local place to drink or whatever, you'd be surprised. You go and Google, you know, and look for something. Search I've done, for example, vegan restaurants in Syracuse. I'm going to Syracuse. My wife's a vegan. I want to look for a vegan restaurant in Syracuse. If I do a Google search, I'll get three or four restaurants. If I do a Yelp search, I'll get a dozen, and those three or four will be pushed way down because they didn't get such good rankings in Yelp. But for whatever reason, Google's serving me up the three that it thinks is relevant, and perhaps a few ads to go along with it. So yeah, it's it is very much a getting towards a monopoly, I should say.
And then the question becomes for Scott Maloof, well, so what? You know, so what if Google is becoming, what if they become a monopoly? You know, Matt Stoller and other writers like him have argued for a while now that our government basically stopped caring about monopoly 40 years ago, that our antitrust streak went out of style with the Watergate babies generation, the so-called Watergate babies in 1975, and it has never come back. And what mechanism would you use to, quote, break them up? So Yelp is arguing, probably in their own interest, that Google has too much power and that it's hurting consumers. But the argument might be, okay, so what? Is there a legal mechanism to change that?
Well, it's funny. First off, with regard to antitrust, that is an incredibly complicated area of law because of the fact that it's really about economics, you know, and you have to think about what's in theory, what do courts want to do? Do they want to define a market incredibly narrowly, you know, radio hosts in the Rochester region, you know, not a ton, versus national radio hosts? You know, you clearly have a monopoly on the former. And the latter, you know, you're very high. But
I have a monopoly on what? Tell me what I have a monopoly on. Well, I have a monopoly on public radio talk shows in Western New York Finger Lakes region.
Right. And then you put your finger on it. It's really hard to say, oh, antitrust is just moribund because of the fact that there's a lot that goes into it. And a lot is about economic analysis. You know, it's the same thing as the Guinness World Book of Records. You know, as soon as you lose your record, just add another adjective. And you're like, okay, we're back on top. We got it. So... But the second part is how would you break them up? I think the first thing you need to say is where is the harm and what's the problem? You know, as Mike pointed to, if I'm doing a search and this search is supposed to be neutral and it's supposed to bring up a bunch of things, you know, and it doesn't, then that is actually not a particularly problematic thing for the government to address. You talk about the FTC, and they have really broad discretion. That's the Fair Trade Commission for unfair business practices. And if Google's saying we're super neutral and we're going to bring these up based upon, you know, I hate this dreaded word, algorithms, we're going to bring it up, and it's not happening, then the FTC can stand it. And also the state's attorney generals. But when you come back to these kind of nebulous, oh, they have too much power, well, explain that to me. What's your real harm? You can't just say they're big and they're very profitable.
Okay. And, but what if the government decided for some reason, this cleared the bar though, for problematic monopoly? Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to cut them down in what way? I mean, do we even have modern precedents that will help us guide what they're going to do in this case?
Well, again, it depends on the harm they're trying to remedy. But regardless of the administration, one should always understand the massive power of government officials, both the bully pulpit, but also their investigatory powers where they can look at. So the Russian ads that, you know, are an issue that have been coming up. Why is that coming out? Because the government has the power to request this kind of data. And finally, they have really strong powers in every sector, whether it's, you know, unfair business practices or the FCC or just financial transactions. Any one of those, as these entities are engaged in them, the government can say, here is where we're going to utilize our power to restrict what you do. So if you're Facebook and your ability to process credit card transactions is hampered, in essence, you have a huge business problem.
Well, when it comes to whether these companies might be going down, here's where I was a little bit confused by Ben Smith's argument in BuzzFeed. Our guests can tell me more of what they think about this. He's kind of pointing to Uber as an example, and he writes the following. This sort of political change happens slowly until it happens fast. Uber provided a new model for a transformative tech giant to crash through with a dark, negative brand. The company's toxic internal culture and rogue business practices were pure extensions of Silicon Valley's cliches, not particularly different from things Microsoft was once admired for, or Amazon's more openly rapacious early years. But the narrative had changed. Inequality and misogyny were Central American concerns, not as easily brushed past. Uber is the only one to go down so far. A pollster recently showed me the numbers that put the favorable numbers on most of the tech giant brands in the 80s and 90s. Only Uber is sub 50. But this process, call it Uberization, seems to be moving in the other's direction. Fast, and it has the potential to cast a shadow over the sunny brands of the other tech giants, end quote. Here's where I think his comment there that we've already seen Uber go down doesn't really line up for me. Number one, people are taking Ubers every day, and it's not like the government swooped in to break them up. They had problems with, yes, misogyny, all kinds of internal cultural issues. It took down Travis Kalanick, their CEO, but it hasn't taken down the company itself. Mike?
No, it hasn't. But anecdotally, what I'm hearing is in most cities where Lyft, its main competitor, operates, Lyft is doing much better than Uber. But, you know, I think one of the, and I'm inclined to sort of agree with you. I'm not quite sure that I follow his argument there. But one of the things I'd like to say about Facebook, for example, and I can probably hear a few million attaboys when I say it, is that I think a lot of these networks would do well to be a lot more transparent. So, for example, when I open up my Facebook newsfeed and I'm getting served ads, I'd like a little line that says, you're being served this ad because you searched within such and such a day. If you'd no longer like to see ads for this product, click here. If they did that, all of a sudden, Facebook is a little bit more transparent and a little bit friendlier. But they don't. It's this black box. Ads come out. You get served up stuff. They're gathering information about me. Who knows what? Who knows where it's going? And that is a problem.
Yeah, Scott, I mean, Uber's fall is falling on its own sword, not necessarily the government's sword, I think.
Right, right. And Mike's right. I mean, one thing is that all tech companies have really had a problem with transparency in that they try to make things simple, they try to make things very friendly, but underneath is a very complicated system that has had value judgments, that has had tough decisions made. And I think to the extent you shield that from the public, you know, you are not helping your cause of transparency. You're not helping your customers really understand. Like, I'll take Yelp as an example. You know, Yelp sees itself as a community, and I am not a Yelp user. So if I went on and had a horrible experience and I reviewed a restaurant, my review is not going to get the same weight as somebody who's reviewed 50 places. And that, I think, is very frustrating because, you know, I get why they do it, but I think it's very frustrating because now that is not transparent unless you really dig into Yelp and understand it. So, you know, it's a good example of a problem.
Yes, but I mean that system is put in place to avoid people who just want to trash someone for the sake of trashing someone.
Absolutely, you know, so, but yeah. You got to be clear about it and say, yeah. Look, you know, we're waiting reviews based upon a set of standards. By the way, going back to Mike's comment about Lyft and Uber, I just did a quick look on the Google Play Store. Lyft, you know, has 10 billion downloads. Uber has 100 million. So people say, you know, Uber's going down, this is it. But they, you know, just on that one anecdote, they've got 10 times the size of a Lyft.
Well, I will say, and I will appeal directly to listeners on this. I was in an Uber a few weeks ago, and one of the co-passengers asked the driver, have you considered driving for Lyft and not Uber, considering Uber's sexual harassment and other problems they have at the top? Which I'm not sure is a fair question for a driver, but it is an interesting point that showed that this particular passenger was worried about it. She'd have rather been in a Lyft. And I wonder if, to Mike and Scott's point, that in these markets where you've got both, that Lyft is doing better, even though they're nowhere near Uber share right now, will that change? I'd love to hear from you. I mean, have you taken these sort of ride-sharing services, ride-hailing services, and does that problem at the top impact you, or do you think, hey, an Uber is an Uber, Lyft's fine? 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. A little tangentially, but I want to ask Mike one more quick question before I move to other topics here, which is Ben Smith is keying on something there was that was the subject of a New York Times story just a few weeks ago about the men's rights movement in Silicon Valley. There's still a lot of men's rights guys, men's rights bros in Silicon Valley. And, you know, and the New York Times story kind of spooked a lot of people, but that culture is still there. And what Ben Smith wrote regarding Uber, he says their company's toxic internal culture and rogue business practices were pure extensions of Silicon Valley's cliches. And he says, the narrative has changed. Inequality and misogyny were Central American concerns now, not as easily brushed past, and that's going to be a problem. So in other words, that sort of men's rights bro culture in Silicon Valley is a cliche, but it's also real if you believe this New York Times story, and that's going to be a problem more than it used to be. Do you think that's right?
I don't know about it more than it used to be, but I know for a fact that anyone that's about to lose perceived power always fights to hang on to it. So if quote-unquote this men's rights thing is a way of hanging on to that perceived power, good luck to them, but you know, they're fighting a big tide.
That article was fascinating, by the way, and we'll find it and post it for you if you want to check it out. Fascinating is one word. That might be a euphemism, but you can check it out if you want to. We'll post that. So before I take our first phone call, what Ben Smith says Facebook and these companies should be doing, well, what's he say? He says, quote, Facebook should probably ease out of the business of bland background statements and awkward photo ops and start worrying about congressional testimony, end quote. That's funny because he wrote this a month before Mark Zuckerberg got in trouble for doing this Puerto Rican adventure thing. And I don't want to sidetrack too much, but Mike Johansson, for people who missed it this week, what did Facebook do and what did Zuckerberg have to do in response?
So somebody at Facebook, probably the virtual reality person, thought it'd be a great idea if she and the boss, Mark Zuckerberg, took a virtual reality tour of the devastation in Puerto Rico, which would have been fine if they'd just gone there and pointed stuff out. But no, their little avatars were smiling, happy little drawings of people. And Mark Zuckerberg has a, you know, the cat that just ate the canary look on his face. And then they do this big awkward high five at some point. Meanwhile, the scenery in the background is this, you know, video footage of total devastation, floodwaters still in place, power lines down. Completely tone deaf. Completely tone deaf. You know, there are, you know, only 13 or 14% of the people have their power back. You know, people are dying there, and they're doing this virtual reality. Look, how cool, we've got this tech, we can do this. Well, if you're going to do it, at least do it with a good purpose, not just to show it off at the expense of people who are suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. But they were kind of came out and said,
yeah, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. And I don't think he can say enough mea culpas. You know, I think it's been sort of a pattern at Facebook. I mean, he, in some sense, he's still a college kid who's like, hey, look, we can do this. Cool.
Right. And Ben Smith, by the way, also thought that a lot of the speculation that Mark Zuckerberg was preparing for a presidential run with his American tour that he did this year, Smith says that is wrong. He writes, quote, tech is manifestly unready for this new era. They've been playing small ball politics of regulation and coasting on incredibly high approval ratings, but there are signs that they feel the wind's changing. You can usually detect a political figure's problems from their overcompensation, and Zuckerberg's Midwestern tour had all the hallmarks of a classic reaction to a specific political polling question. Does he care about people like me? The move was widely misinterpreted as some kind of beginning to Zuckerberg's political career, but Zuckerberg is Facebook, and his image is his company's. His mission was to fix the company's image, and I'm just not sure this one is fixable, end quote. Did you think he was running for president, or do you agree with Ben Smith? He was trying to soften Facebook's image as more of the people.
Yeah, I sort of gave him the benefit of the doubt. I think he actually wanted to get out of Silicon Valley and meet some real Americans. And, you know, the images of him sitting down at a farm table in a farmhouse having dinner with the folks, you know, it's good PR, and I hope he listened to real people. You know, I hope he got some red and some blue. I don't know what really happened, and I don't really know the motivation, but it was good PR for him.
You know, I think Mark Zuckerberg has been tone deaf in a lot of ways, but I think he's still got just enough self-awareness to know that he's not going to be president. But I've said that about other people, and I've been wrong. So let me grab Noel in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Noel.
Hey, no, that's there, Kevin. My solution to the identity search issue is to have a totally fictitious identity on Google Chrome.
A fictitious identity?
Yeah, I pick a birthday that I like, and, you know, I don't really live in Rochester, even though my IP address would ignore that, and, you know, just create total fictitious, and I don't, you know, so I don't worry about it. The ads are irritating sometimes, but, you know, and then you got to scroll down and ignore all of those links that are identified as advertised links.
Hmm. All right, Noah. Well, I don't know if everyone has sort of the drive to create a false persona online.
Actually,
but what do you think, Scott?
Actually, that's more common than you'd think.
Wow.
And I think, one, a lot of folks do that just for the reasons that the caller stated, which was, I can't avoid these issues, so I'm going to create a false persona. But two, you're seeing it in a lot of different environments. You're seeing college students create that because, going back to kind of where we started, you know, once social, once these technologies become a hassle, but you still have to use them, you say, how do I find ways to work around it? So you have people in college and high school who have a public Instagram and a personal Instagram. The personal one is who they actually feel like they are. They share it in a tight circle. The public one is with their real name, and it's searchable. You know, the same thing. So I think that is actually not an uncommon response. And that's a real problem for the tech companies. Let's go back to where they started. If you're Facebook, if you're any of these companies, and you're selling ads, you need that data to be correct. And to the extent your user base are saying, I'm going to revolt by providing incorrect data.
Oh, I like this.
Then you have a problem. Now, again, the user pointed out a really good point, was you can only go so far. Your IP address, your operating system, things like that are still going to be automatically provided. But therein is a really, really key issue that a lot of companies are having to think about.
Well, and
there is software. There is software to spoof your IP address.
Mm.
So you can hide that too. But there is a dark side to that too. So, you know, a future employer in certain industries goes to look you up, see what they can find about Google, and finds almost no activity on the web. That's almost as bad as finding something bad about somebody in this day and age. I mean, I think we need to get to the stage where enough people have one little ink blot in their past out on the web that it becomes forgivable for everybody. And I think we'll get there eventually. We're just not quite there yet. So,
a couple of listener responses. On Twitter, Janice writes to us and says that her views of these big tech brands over the years have changed monumentally. She says, I feel somewhat helpless watching ourselves being destroyed with tools that were supposed to make things better, end quote. James says, I've got major shifts in my opinions, mostly in the negative across the board. Eric says, a friend of mine chose to drive for Lyft in Rochester, not Uber, because of his feelings about Uber's treatment of women. Interesting. And I want to read an email from a listener named Mike, who kind of thinks we maybe shouldn't overgeneralize here. He says, Evan, nice topic. With the dramatic growth and consolidation of big tech, their power has also grown dramatically. So there's a wide range of public benefit, trustworthiness, and reprehensible behavior among big tech companies. On one end of the spectrum are corporations like Monsanto, Big Tobacco, Big Food, some big pharma, and others who should not be trusted because of their highly reprehensible behavior that includes killing people for profit, demonstrably so and all too common, and lesser reprehensible behaviors. On the other end of the spectrum are corporations like Google and Apple who truly appear to care about and promote their customers' interest. Then there's the widespread middle ground occupied by the likes of Amazon, who work hard to deliver value to their customers but simultaneously undermine their customers' privacy in reprehensible ways and work to engineer society to their own to their owners' liking and to the detriment of most of their customers, society in general, and our collective posterity. As with most public policy issues, it would be complex and many factors are at play. That's from Mike there. Mike Johansson, what do you think?
Well, I love the idea of the spectrum. I don't know that I agree that necessarily that Google's at the, quite at such a good end of the spectrum. But
he's got Google on the almost the altruistic side.
Yeah, almost with a halo. And I don't know that I'd push him out quite that far. But no, I like the idea of the spectrum. I would say that in some respects, as we were talking earlier, you use all these things for free, quote marks around the word free, because the companies are able to get some data from you and they're able to monetize that. They've got to pay bills too. They've got huge server farms they've got to supply energy to. They've got to keep building these things. So free is, you know, I don't know that I'd put Google all the way up.
Okay, Scott. But no, Mike puts his finger on the real issue. Free is the word in the sense of go back to your utility model. Once I start paying for a service, a ton of rights adhere. You know, my state attorney general is going to get involved. My credit card company, the rules of contract, as opposed to free, where the rules are pretty much going to be, it's a free service, take it or leave it, very generally. And that's a real challenge as we seek to regulate these services. Now, the advertisers who are paying real money, you know, can easily step in and say, I've paid you quite a bit. You really need to perform for me.
On Twitter, James follows up to say, I feel Google and Amazon at least still have major potential for great change and positive influence on the world, but there is a lack of oversight. So I want to reset this for you here. We're talking about the future of big tech, and it was an article by Ben Smith in BuzzFeed, really interesting article about why he thinks big tech is primed for a big fall. When we say big tech, we're talking Google, Facebook, Amazon, maybe a few others. And Ben Smith is arguing that they've gotten too big, too powerful, and they've made some mistakes, some oversteps, overreaches with our privacy, with our information, that there's going to be a public backlash, and that you already have Steve Bannon and Bernie Sanders, for example, operating on different ends of politics, saying that they should be regulated more like a utility, that they should be taken down, that they should be busted up in some way. Well, we've talked this half hour about how the challenges are in place to actually treat them as in the antitrust world. Maybe it could happen, but there are some hurdles there. After our break, we'll come back and say, well, what about a utility? Could they actually be regulated like a utility? Is that likely? And then we'll get into what Tyler Cowen had to say about why he thinks that there are some cultural and context issues that we should all be aware of, especially in the Facebooks of the world. He's pointing at Russian influence, but he's also pointing at the day-to-day way we use it. So all of that coming up next with our guests here, Mike Johansson, who is a lecturer at RIT in the School of Communication and a social media consultant with Fixitology. And Scott Maloof is an attorney whose work focuses on the intersection between social media and the law. You can find Scott online at scottmaloof.com, M-A-L-O-U-F. We're coming right back on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, the Gay Alliance is becoming the Out Alliance, and they have a lot of work to do. The Trump administration's Justice Department has been going after LGBTQ rights when it comes to Title IX and protections in the workplace. So we'll talk about what's being argued in court, how it could affect the LGBTQ community. We'll talk about local history, the name change, and a lot more. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. As always, we get such interesting stuff from our listeners and a lot of really good emails. I'm going to read as many as I can in our remaining minutes here as we talk about the future of big tech. First of all, Mike writes to us, a different Mike, and says, what concerns, if any, do your guests have about many of our schools buying into Google, hook, line, and sinker for all of their students' and teachers' needs? He's talking about Google Classroom, all being on the cloud, things like that. That's from Mike. Mike Johansson? As a lecturer, communications.
Yeah, exactly. I've been saying this for years. Actually, we're going to live on planet Google sooner or later. Yeah, possibly later. But the fact of the matter is Google offers so many great services, it's hard for cash-strapped schools to not take advantage of them. And I get that completely. But of course, the downside is I'm not sure that the schools, the parents, school boards necessarily understand what they're giving up to get this stuff. And when you look at competitors, they're just not quite as good. They're just not quite as fast. The services offered aren't just quite as broad. And so it's not really a level playing field.
Okay. This comes from Dan, who says, who ultimately has the power to change our course with this? Who has the most power to rein in the excesses of these massive, incredibly influential, and increasingly sketchy companies? As the consumers of their goods and services, we do. We vote with our dollars, clicks, attention, our personal information, and our willingness to give the benefit of the doubt. If these companies and their services, convenient as they may be, are ultimately destructive to our local economies and personal well-being, we can stop giving them our money and allegiance. Perhaps we'll be stronger and better off not leaning on them so much. Great conversation. That's from Dan.
And Dan's point is right. I mean, at the end of the day, the power in these choices are ours, and we've got to make them. You know, if you want local economy, you got to shop local. You can't just keep using Amazon at 3 a.m. I mean, and the same thing with how we utilize these technologies. We talk about trolls and ways we're going to get rid of them. But at the end of the day, we as users have got to be a little savvier about how we read and interpret things, but also how we post things and what we do. And I know you've said that many times in the past.
Yeah, I agree that we do vote with everything that we do is sort of it's a voting with your wallet. It's voting with your feet, your attention. Dan is absolutely right about that. Some of the frustration, and Scott was bringing this up during the break, if a lot of the feedback we're getting, and we're getting a lot of feedback, but it's not a scientific sample. There's a lot of negative feedback about the images of these companies. In other words, people are saying, yes, over the last 5 years, my views have gotten more dark when I think about Facebook, Google, Amazon. That's true. But Scott, you were saying during the break, some of that is the frustration that people feel like I'm frustrated because I don't have alternatives. I have to use them.
Right. You're being compelled to use it. Mike mentioned it. So if you're a parent and the school has gone to Google, then you're forced to sign on and be a user. Same thing with Facebook. Facebook is trying to get into work, you know, and have work groups use Facebook to chat and things like that. You may have a lot of users who say, I don't use it. Other users at the older end of the spectrum who never got onto Facebook, or users at the younger end who say, I don't like Facebook. I'm only on Instagram, Facebook company, but still. And therein is the rub where you're being forced to. The exception being Oregon, where there is a state statute that says your employer cannot force you to join a particular social network.
Okay, so, Mike, when it comes to alternatives, you said during the break there's something called Jet as an example that people say, well, I don't want to use Amazon.
Yeah, so use Jet. but you'll find the choices are a little narrower.
Service is slower?
Service can be a little slower, and it can be a little less convenient in terms of the actual ordering process. But if you don't like Amazon, there is an alternative out there. It's a bit like, you know, back in the day, I think 20 years ago, I really took a bad rub to a big box store that I won't name, said I'm never going to this place again. And then I found out that one particular grocery item that I particularly liked is now only available at the big box store. Now I have to make a choice. Do I give up my favorite grocery item or to you know, keep my boycott going? Well, in the case I did, and over the years I've sort of, it's been a tough choice, but I did, you know, so... Scott's right. We do vote with our wallets. We do vote with choices. It's really a question of, in terms of like Amazon versus Jet, it's not a level playing field. I mean, one is dominant. It can get you your stuff in 2 days, one day if you're willing to pay. They'll be having drones delivering stuff before you know it. The other guy's struggling to get off the ground.
So go ahead.
I was just going to pick up, you know, Mike mentioned a food item. Organic is a really good concept to me of how we deal with this. You know, 15 years ago, if you wanted organic food, you either were going to the farm or you're going to a specialty store. You know, now you can get organic food. Wegmans is a huge selection. Walmart even has it. But yet, if you're really trying to kind of be out there, go back to your vegan comment, you're really going to that specialty store. And I think as a user, you know, they're selling something else. They're selling advice. They're saying our price may be a little higher, but we're right here in your community. And I think that's what we as users have got to do in all aspects. If I'm going to use a service for email, you've got to do more than just give me my email. Maybe I require more of you to give back.
Yes. To Scott's point, maybe something that you want to purchase is local, but it's more expensive. well, what are your values? Mike Johansson made a decision years ago that his favorite grocery item was only selling in the big box store that he did not want to support because of its deleterious effects on other local small businesses, and he gave it up. So to Dan's emailing point, and I don't want to speak for Dan, but I assume Dan would say, yes, those are the types of decisions we have to make. And it's sometimes going to be less convenient or more expensive, but it might be better, and we've got to make that decision if we want to make change. Now, Mike, I just want to know, was it Vegemite?
No.
It wasn't Vegemite.
But for years, I had to have family in New Zealand mail it to me, so because you couldn't get it in this country. Now Wegmans sells it.
You're talking about Vegemite?
Yeah.
So I thought Vegemite was an Australian thing, not a New Zealand thing.
It is. My mother was Australian. Most of my schoolmates would eat Marmite, but I was a Vegemite kid because that's what my mom.
So if you haven't ever had Vegemite, by the way, it's like peanut butter that tastes like somebody crushed aspirin and put it in it. It's like medicine.
No, it's a yeast extract that you spread very sparingly on a cheese sandwich.
You're not selling it well.
Salty.
You're
not delicious.
It's delicious. Like, yeah, it is not selling it.
Did not see things going this direction.
No.
I'll bring sandwiches next time I come.
We're doing. If you bring a Vegemite sandwich, you might not get invited back. It's been a number of years. I'm always open to changing my mind. So maybe we're talking about the future of big tech here, with Mike Johansson and Scott Maloof, and I want to circle back to a point that came right out of the top of the show, which is if big tech is headed for a downfall, like Ben Smith thinks in BuzzFeed, and he's not the only one, by the way. In recent weeks, a lot of people have taken that piece and said, yes, let me expand on this point. We think that this is coming, that Google, Facebook, Amazon, they're too big for their own good, too much political power, too many bad decisions, and that there's going to be a backlash of some kind, whether it's politically or in the public. But if it's politically, if it's in the government arena, the Bannons and Bernie Sanders of the world want them to regulate these companies as utilities. That's different than saying the internet should be a utility, but let's talk about what that means. Scott, you don't seem to think that Facebook is ever going to be considered a utility and regulated that way.
You know, remember, when we talk about utilities, utility law, where utilities came from, this is over 100 years old. You know, electricity comes up, somebody sets up a power plant. Pretty quickly, folks realize, all right, we, the local folks, have got to regulate this. We cannot have, you know, lights strung up on the streets and then have the company go bankrupt and not provide power. You know, we have to understand how are they outputting, you know, the product that they have. You know, if you're using coal, what do you do with the coal ash after it's done? So you have 50 states that all regulate utilities. So that model is not particularly strong to regulate something that literally emanates from one state or a few states with their servers. And you're going to have the West Virginia Facebook, the New York Facebook. Secondly, you know, Mike referenced it, we really don't pay in dollars, which is how we traditionally have seen, you know, regulation flow. People pay for things, they're not getting what they paid for, therefore the government steps in. Here we're paying with this concept, our information, but we have very rarely said our information has a monetary value and we are going to control how it's used. I think the model actually is more going to be data regulation, where we see certain kinds of information are tagged, and because of who you are and how you got that info, that information has to be handled in a certain way. That may be more likely where we're going to go.
Okay, and when it comes to treating a company like a utility, that's different than recent calls to treat the internet as a utility.
Right.
Is that more likely eventually?
I mean, I suppose that can be likely, but again, it's going to have to grow out of what's the harm we're trying to resolve. You know, if we are just complaining that people troll people on Facebook, treating the internet like a, you know, utility is probably not going to solve that.
Scott, when it comes to the public's views on this, I'm guessing that some people might hear this, what you're saying, and say, well, if it's information or the way information is required or what they're hearing, why should we trust the government to regulate how companies are accessing our private information or what they're doing with our information when the government wants our information? You know, in other words, the government's going to call out companies, but the government itself is collecting our data.
Well, I'm not so sanguine about that.
Right.
Let's just do a practical example. So let's talk about you, Evan. You go to the doctor. The doctor writes down your information. Okay, so how is that information then used? Well, HIPAA, you know, the federal law that controls how that information is used,
is a good model. It says, okay, one, what's the data? The data is Evan's medical record. Two, who has it and why do they have it? Evan's doctor has it because he had to go to the doctor. And three, what's the expectation of how that data is controlled? It can only be shared amongst people for purposes of Evan's care. So, you know, someone can't slide in and log in and say, oh, what's going on with Evan? You know, that's what I'm talking about when we talk about data regulation. There's tons of different statutes. Illinois and Texas and I think Washington State regulate biometric information. So if there was an iris scan in order to get into XXI, that's actually how we get in here, right? It's very high tech. Nope. But if you scan somebody's fingerprint or iris, that's called biometric information. Okay. And a few states regulate. If you collect it, you got to tell people how you're going to use it. You got to have a plan for destroying it. So there are many statutes, both on the state and federal level, that talk about that stuff. And I think that's probably a more useful way of saying you tech companies have got to do something to be responsible to the public.
Okay. Mike, you agree with that?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, and obviously be transparent about it. Another thing that I think that could happen, although I think it's unlikely to, but I think it's been proposed, I think in South Africa, and I'm drawing a blank on the other country, is to have a public commission where people can take complaints about these companies and the way they're either handling information or not taking care of a problem. And it has to rise to a certain level, but I know that in Facebook's case, they're kind of concerned that this commission might actually come into being in South Africa and that they're going to have to appear before it when something's not going well for Facebook users in South Africa. Could it get awful clunky? Could it be an real pain in the you-know-what for Facebook? Absolutely. But I think to this point, Facebook's actually been skating along pretty lightly and getting away with a lot and making a lot of money without really having to do a lot of due diligence about care of data or taking care of bad actors like Russians posting ads.
And I think they would argue, were they here? Look, we've got privacy policy. We have tons of people who are in charge of these issues. But Mike's point is well taken. In Germany, the same thing. They've just had the German regulation of, illegal content come online. And you basically, the tech companies have got 24 hours to take clearly illegal content down. Otherwise, they face very large fines. And by large fines, up to, in theory, 50 million euros. As well as they've got a week to react to questionable content. And that clearly grows from people saying, I am frustrated with seeing something that, were this in paper or were this down the street, I would be able to handle it. But since it's online, we can't deal with it. So yeah, I think that's a definite concern, the more responsiveness and government stepping in to provide the responsiveness.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about Russia. Tyler Cowen, writing for Bloomberg Online, wrote a piece that said, quote, the headline was, Facebook's harm is taking life out of context. And he says what once seemed like a social problem is becoming a civic one as well. He writes, quote, it's been rough recently for Facebook. Further information came out that Russian agents had used the service to organize rallies in support of U.S. President Donald Trump and to buy pro-Trump ads. Here's his main point. I want to read from this and we'll see what our guests think. Quote, for all the wonders of contemporary technology, Facebook is not so good at producing social context. Let's consider the Russian organization of pro-Trump rallies. In older times, you could imagine a Russian guy on an American street corner trying to hand out leaflets, speaking to passers-by in his accent, trying to recruit them for Marxist causes. It probably wouldn't go well, in large part because the surrounding social context would make it clear what was going on, namely a clumsy attempt to boost a foreign cause for self-serving reasons. Today, the same Russian could place an ad on Facebook, whether for Trump or for a fascist cause. With a minimum of professional effort, it can look just as good as the ads for more legitimate groups and not betray its origins. Low transaction costs lead to more good stuff, such as your nice Facebook posts, but they also enable more bad communications. When surrounding social cues are stripped away, we don't always know how to interpret or dismiss the bad messages on the site, end quote. Mike.
Yeah, in fact, New York Times reported, I think 2 weeks ago, I might have mentioned this to you guys earlier, a story where Twitter had found that when the first taking a knee situation in the NFL broke out and the president tweeted about it, that Russian-backed accounts were buying ads and posting on hashtags on both sides of the thing, essentially just sowing divisiveness.
On purpose, just on
on purpose, yeah.
And it looked like it was working. It was at least it was going to be a divisive issue anyway, but it was contributing to some of the heat.
Right, divisiveness. Let's jump in and fan the flames.
Yeah. And so, Scott, thoughts on that before I go to Tyler Cowen's conclusion, which I thought was interesting, but thoughts on his point about the lack of context and what concerns we might have, or whether that can be regulated or changed?
Well, I think from day one, this has been an issue on the internet. You know, the old joke about you don't know who you're talking to if they're a dog or not. And, I think context is online services, particularly social, are terrible at context. And so you have to take everything with a grain of sand. Secondly, people tend to respond too quickly, too vehemently, too nastily online. You know, whether it's to make themselves feel better or to beat somebody else down. And that's a mistake. You would never do that in person. And so I think, to the extent that, you've got to self-contextualize and say, would I say this to Evan in person? If I wouldn't, then maybe I shouldn't do it online. And hopefully, again, as users, we can be the source of the solution.
Yeah, Mike?
Well, I was just going to say, and the other thing is that this cries out for more media education, starting in kindergarten or before. Next week, RIT is sending me down to New York City to speak to the alumni club there, and the talk's jokingly sort of described as friends, fakes, and how to figure it out. And it literally sold out in a day when it was posted, because apparently everyone wants to know about this stuff. And I'm not here offering any great insights other than essentially just to be a spoiler for my own talk next week. I'm basically going to be telling people a lot of it's on you. When you're out there, you've got to look at everything skeptically, and you've got to ask yourself the question, why is this real? Why do I trust this versus that? Where is it coming from?
Yeah, and I kind of look at this as if you're consuming media and it's too good to be true, you should ask yourself the office rule. Give yourself 4 seconds and say, where's the office that published this? And if you can't identify it from memory, then you need to be a little more skeptical.
And Facebook, in fairness, actually is doing one positive thing. Now, I haven't seen it yet, but certain users, when a link is shared, are getting a little button on the right-hand side of an image or a headline that you can click for more information about the source and how credible that source might be.
Yeah. And we're Yelp here. They would say we don't have this problem because we weight users on how many reviews and we legitimize them, to bring it full circle.
Mike, to your point on education, an emailer named Dan earlier this hour making a very valuable, powerful point about how we can change this with our own actions. But I don't think some version of big tech anyway is going away. I don't think social media is necessarily going away anytime soon. Certainly our cell phones and the way our smartphones are, that is part of our society, probably not going away. So are you seeing more emphasis on media literacy and education at the lower levels from your experience in this community?
I've heard about it in the Irondequoit School District that I'm part of, just anecdotally. I don't know a lot about it. But I would say whatever they're doing right now is not enough, period, for parents or for kids. Because honestly, we're in a world now where it's so media rich, you literally can't avoid it. You can be sitting on a bus or a subway and there'll be people on either side of you streaming something. You can see something on a screen. You cannot avoid media. The gas station I visit on the thruway now, there's news playing on the little screen at the gas pump, interspersed with ads, and they're doing it in 10-second increments because they know I'm not going to be there very long. So 10 seconds, 10 seconds, 10 seconds.
I know. I'm going, can't I just access these fossil fuels and feel bad about myself in quiet peace and solitude? Do I always need some sort of media? It is ubiquitous. And listeners, if you know what's going on in your school district, email me or let us know, connections@wxxi.org. It's a great question because I think, again, Mike is speaking from his experience in his district, but I'd love to hear from where you are. And is this being addressed more?
I just want to bring up two things. One, we have to be aware that there's multiple contexts as well, or multiple user groups, in the sense that somebody in their 20s and somebody who's in their 50s or somebody who only accesses things mobily has one set of experiences versus somebody who's basically on their computer. We got to be aware of that. But two is across all those groups is user fatigue. A friend of mine teaches at a community college, and he said, you know what? A lot of my students will write about they're exhausted with these dating apps and how the grass is always greener on the other side and they can't form relationships because the app is interceding. So I think we as users and people commenting on it need to be aware of there is a really rich dialogue going on.
Well, Tyler Cowen concludes his piece for Bloomberg with this. He says, frankly, I don't see what we have to lose from spending less time on Facebook. Research indicates that social media use is often a kind of addiction. It doesn't make most people happier, but causes them to feel alienated, end quote. And I think there's probably a lot to be said for that, but some final thoughts, about 30 seconds apiece. Scott and Mike, you know, you may not agree with everything Ben Smith wrote in BuzzFeed about the coming fall for big tech, but what do you think is likely to happen with big tech? They stay, they respond to the public a little bit better, they behave better. What do you think?
You know, you see waterproof phones. And I think that's proof that big tech is here to stay because people can't, you know, feel like they got to take it into the water park with them.
That's so sad.
I think those were invented for people who have them fall out of their pocket into the toilet, actually, because I think that's one of the places they get used a lot.
I have heard more stories of cell phones dying in a toilet. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that's why they were waterproof, to be perfectly honest. And we all know that's where they get used a lot. But on a more serious note, I know there's the host, put his head in hands.
Yes.
On a more serious note, I think these companies, it would behoove them to be better actors. Can they do it themselves without regulation? They can. Will they? Who knows?
Right. Well, thank you to both Scott Maloof and Mike Johansson. And Mike, I promise you that sometime soon, if you want, if you just want to smile and hand me a Vegemite sandwich, I will eat it.
All right.
Next time you're here, bring me a Vegemite sandwich and we'll have a taste test.
Next time is a pledge drive. We can probably raise dollars around that.
Oh, we've got a drive starting Friday. Maybe Vegemite for everybody. John Andrus, the engineer, is shaking his head. He wants no part of that. Mike Johansson is a lecturer in the School of Communication at RIT and a social media consultant with Fixitology. Always great having you, Mike. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Maloof is an attorney whose work focuses on the intersection between social media and the law. Thank you. It's always good to have you, Scott, even if you're not a Vegemite fan. Thank you, Scott.
My pleasure.
All right, more connections coming up.